Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Greg Priddy.
Hi, Diane. How are you?
I am well. How are you?
I'm doing okay.
Yeah?
Perking right along here. You know, fall's my season, so.
And it is. It is fall. It's cooling
it's
right
coming.
Now.
Yeah, yeah. Coming along nicely.
I'm ready, I think.
Good.
We'll see. We're getting ready to wind up for our trip to Las Vegas and to go to Interbike.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I got some interesting people lined up for interviews in the show studio. I'll be calling in next week, so y'all can be all excited about 97 degrees and no humidity in Las Vegas. That's what the forecast is for next week.
Nice.
Hot and sunny.
It won't matter to you because you're going to be inside in the air conditioning all day anyway.
Every place you go is air conditioned. The outside is air conditioned.
Just about.
Just about. You know, you go from building to sort of these walkways to another building to a walkway, and even the walkways feel like they're air conditioned. It's bizarre. Las Vegas is bizarre.
Yeah.
That's probably the best word for it.
Yeah.
So I finally uploaded my blog.
Yes.
Yeah, outspokencyclist.com. Back shows aren't completely in, but thanks to you, I am having a lot less work than I thought I'd have to do.
Good.
Yeah. You'll be able to listen from your computer, download a podcast, click on all the links. Everything was working so far. I think I have like 7 shows and 2 other posts up there already. The shows are going to be listed in reverse chronological order, and hopefully all the tags and links will work. They do so far. And people will be able to make comments.
Good.
If they like. And they'll also be able to make suggestions, which I like, too. Like, one of our guests tonight came from a suggestion on our Facebook page.
Okay.
I've been asked more than a few times whether or not there will be an RSS feed, and you explained it to me. And yes, there will be, or there is.
There is one from the WJCU site currently.
And there will be one from the Outspoken Cyclist blog, according to Carrie, definitely.
Yeah, I would say that's pretty standard.
Yeah.
So that's good. Will the guests be searchable by name
yes.
when this is all done?
Everything's tagged.
Okay.
I like the layout. It's an interesting layout. It's a WordPress theme, as they call it. It took me a while to find one I liked, and it made sense to use. So, yes, everything is searchable. So if you search on, say, for example, cyclocross, which is a topic we'll have tonight, that will come up. If you search on somebody's last name, that will come up.
Oh, okay.
What do you think?
Good. Yeah.
Yeah. So, over the past couple of weeks, we've been talking about Ride for Miles.
And that's coming up
tomorrow.
Yeah.
Are you riding with us?
Yes.
We're riding with you.
Whether I want you to or not? No, just kidding.
No, we had fun last year.
We did, and we're going to have fun this year, too.
It starts right here on the campus of John Carroll. The ride is not the only event that is taking place over the weekend, though, as we know. Professor Miles Coburn was an environmentalist, a biology professor here, and along with the memorial ride, there are a series of other interesting things going on, one of which was a lecture last night at the Cleveland Museum of Natural History by journalist and author Jeff Mapes. Jeff is the political columnist for The Oregonian, lives in Portland, Oregon, and wrote the book Peddling Revolution. Before his lecture, I was fortunate enough to corral him in the studio to discuss his book and his ideas about why cycling is changing the way we see cities, transportation, and our futures. So he is our guest at the bottom of the hour today, and he will be our only guest at the bottom of the hour, and that's pretty exciting. As I said earlier in the beginning of our opening here, that we could use the word cyclocross. Richard Fries, who's a really big shot guy in cycling, I'll have you know. Actually, he's on his way. We catch him in Chicago O'Hare boarding a plane on his way to the Netherlands. He's going to be announcing the world championships. But he also is involved in a project called Providence Cyclocross Fest, which is coming up October 6th and 7th. And so he's been a few minutes with me talking about Providence Cyclocross Fest. Evidently, cyclocross is racing in New England. Everything else is warm-up. And then we're going to talk with Tina Kuna. Out of the charitable work she does to help feed the hungry came an idea for a ride called Living the Dream Ride. It's scheduled for Mother's Day weekend of 2013, so it's in May, May 11th, I think. The ride is specifically targeted to women and includes some pampering we don't usually associate with riding your bike. Tina's going to talk about living the dream, her company Dream Dinners, and the Snohomish Washington Soup Kitchen, which will directly benefit from the proceeds of this unusual and sounds like fun event. There's news this week. We'll get to as much of it as we can. So let's enjoy the show as we welcome Richard Fries to the Outspoken Cyclist. Richard, thanks for joining us this evening.
Oh, it's great to be here. You guys do great work. And really good to be here. I'm sorry. I'm in an airport, but we're getting ready for a big thing in New England.
Yes, you are. Glenn Stilwell contacted me through our Outspoken Cyclist Facebook page and said, you need to talk to Richard about the Providence Cyclocross Festival. So go ahead and tell us about it, when it is, what it is, where it is.
Sure. Providence, Rhode Island. It's the fourth annual Providence Cyclocross Festival. UCI racing both days. It's a Category 1, the highest you can get on day one. What's really cool about it is that New England is the only part of the country where you have two Category 1 UCI races in the same region. And not only that, we are 1 week and just 90 miles away from Gloucester. So, you know, if you want to play hockey, you go to Canada. You want to race cross, you go to New England. Our locals, we refer to this week between Gloucester and Providence, we call it Holy Week. And we even have a race on Wednesday. We call that Ash Wednesday.
I see. So it's Holy Cross Week. Is that your point?
Just Holy Week, yes.
Holy Week. I got
week
it.
Of, it's the biggest single week of cross racing in America.
Now, is it, when you say Gloucester, is that Richard Sachs is involved in that one?
Nope. He'll be there to race. Richard does a lot with it. It's the 14th running of Gloucester, an amazing race. They'll have about 5,000 spectators. You know, in a lot of the country, and a lot of your listeners, they think cross is a little thing. Well, in New England, all the bike racers stop racing in August. We call all the road and mountain bike season the preseason.
Got it.
Because in New England, if you don't race cross, you don't race bikes.
That's interesting. How many racers are you going to have at this event, and how many categories?
Oh, gosh, we run about 8 different slots per day. We just only have so much daylight that we can run them in. And we have 8 slots. We expect to have 1,700 to 1,800 entrants. So that's around 800, 900 each day.
Wow.
And we have all the best coming. We have riders from Denmark, Belgium, Czech Republic, France. It's just probably going to be the greatest international field we've ever assembled for Providence.
So before you disappear into the belly of this plane, it's going to be October 6th and 7th?
October 6th and 7th, and your listeners, if they want to check it out, we're going to be live webcast on October 6th.
Oh, cool.
And that will be on cyclingdirt.com, which is a great, great outlet for your listeners to check out world-class cyclocross.
And it's Providence Cross Fest. .com, and we'll post a link to that. So good luck with this year's race. I'm glad I got to catch up with you.
Well, stop by and visit our friends at Shimano. We're part of the Shimano New England Pro Series.
Okay.
They're going to be talking about it, and you go up and tell them you're giving a good plug for Providence, and maybe Shimano starts buying some ads on your site. Huh?
Wouldn't that be interesting?
I will help you with that.
All right, Richard, you have a really, really good flight over, and I'll talk to you again.
Excellent. Thanks. I'm really flattered.
Thank you. I'm very pleased and honored. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Richard Fries joined us from a jetway at Chicago O'Hare Airport.
Yes, he did.
He's getting ready to get on a plane for the Netherlands. You know, it's a reminder that all over the country, really, this is starting to get into this full swing of cross season. So,
yes, it is. I thought this was very timely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think there are a series of races coming up in Northeast Ohio.
Always. There's a cross series
now
here.
Through November.
It should be starting very soon, I wonder
if Bill Gibson is running his Blue Skies or not race again this year. We have to find out about
that. It's funny you say that. I thought about it the other day and did not check into it because I've been so busy trying to get ready to get out of town.
Well, do that when you come back, will
I
you?
Will indeed.
Okay. Hey, let's move along to our next guest.
Okay.
Which is very exciting, what
yes.
she's doing.
Tina Kuna is going to talk to us from Snohomish, Washington. Sounds like a really cool place. And tell us about her new ride, the Living the Dream Ride. Tina, thanks for joining us on the Outspoken Cyclist this evening.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome. So I came across information about your Living the Dream Ride, and I wanted to find out more about it. I know the ride is for women only. Tell us how you came about putting this ride on and when it is and where it is.
Okay, well, the ride is the Living the Dream Ride, which is in Snohomish, Washington, in Washington State, and it is on May 11th, so it's on the Saturday right before Mother's Day. And the women's ride actually came out of another fundraiser that we do every year for the past 8 years, which is a local ride in the Seattle-Portland area called the STP.
We know the STP,
sure.
Seattle to Portland.
Absolutely.
Yep.
So we actually purchased, we have a group of guys who for the past 8 years have been riding beach cruiser bikes for the 200 miles.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, as a fundraiser. And a few years ago, the Living the Dream Foundation, which has started the women's ride, purchased cruiser bikes for this group of guys to ride the STP. And we decided that we really wanted to use those cruiser bikes as a fundraiser, not only for the STP, but for future rides.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So really the women's ride came out of the beach cruiser ride bikes. Not that we are encouraging women to ride beach cruiser bikes on our women's ride, but it kind of evolved from that and really became an event that we want to nurture women. We want to uplift them and just have it a pampering day and really focus on making it a fun event for them, for their friends, great fitness, great exercise, and you get a little special gift at the end.
So it's women only, no kids?
Yep, kids can ride.
Oh, cool.
We won't be exclusive. We won't, if a man wants to ride with us, we're more than happy to have him join us. But we're really focusing on making this a nurturing day for women.
Nice. So manicures and pedicures included? Just kidding.
We are looking into setting up manicures, pedicures.
Oh, cool.
Massages.
Awesome. Maybe I'll fly
treats.
Out.
Yeah. Oh, that would be lovely.
Yeah. That's very cool. So have you ridden STP? Are you a bike rider yourself?
No, I am not. My
okay.
husband was actually one of the guys that started the fundraiser STP ride.
Okay.
I'm usually driving the support crew.
Right. Okay.
So I decided that this time this is really going to be about women, and I might jump on a bike.
So I know that there's a rider limit of 500. Does that include all riders? So you're gonna cap your ride at 500 this year.
We are.
Okay.
We are.
And I don't think that's a bad idea. At least you'll know how much food and all that stuff instead
exactly.
of having day of. So,
exactly.
And I know they'll be able to sign up online and all of that. But I want to talk a little bit more about the logistics of the ride. How many different routes will you have? How many distances?
We have four different routes. So we have 18, 24, 36, and 62.
Nice.
Yeah.
Are they hilly?
It's not too hilly. There are a few little challenging, but it really is a ride where it's a great training ride for anyone getting ready for the STP or some other local rides. But it's the 18 mile is of a flatter surface, so that anyone who's just starting out or hasn't ridden a bike in quite a while, this will be the perfect route for them. The Snohomish area is a smaller town, very historic, antique town. Farmland.
Nice.
So a lot of our routes are going to be along pastures and hot air balloons and farmland. And we have a few little hills in there, but it's just a gorgeous, gorgeous area. And it's a very bike-friendly town. Another ride that comes through our town is the RSVP that just came through, which is the, Ride Seattle to Vancouver, then party, which is happened about 2 weeks ago.
Oh, it's like Ragbri on the West Coast.
Yes.
Okay, so you're raising money for the Snohomish Community Kitchen, and food is a big part of who you are, what you do, and living the dream is also tied into dream dinners. Very interesting concept for somebody like me who doesn't cook.
Well, it's for people like you who don't cook. It's for people who like to cook, but they don't have the time. We really started Dream Dinners because we wanted to help people get a healthy dinner on the table and spend time around the table. If you're a single person, and a lot of times you'll have a bowl of cereal because you don't feel like making or don't like to make dinner. But it's also about families and that magical things happen around the dinner table. And we think that it's such an important part of a child growing up, that dinner around that table sometimes is the only time you're going to get to connect with your kids, is maybe that half an hour or hour that you spend around the table. So that's why we started Dream Dinners. We have a nonprofit organization that's called Living the Dream Foundation, that any of our special events that we do really do focus around fundraising for helping families and children. And the Snohomish Soup Kitchen is a local organization, nonprofit organization, that provides a hot meal to anyone in need twice a week.
So it's nurturing, it's food, it's women. It sounds like it's a very concise and focused package, which I really like that concept. I think that's awesome. And people who might be interested in Dream Dinners, it's a franchise.
It is a franchise.
And I went online and I kind of looked at it, and it was very interesting how you put together these dinners.
Yeah, we have stores across the United States. We have about 90 stores. Seven of our stores are in Ohio, and you can go into one of our locations, and we have a monthly menu that changes every month, and you can assemble your dinners. So all the recipe is set up in stations. We do all the chopping, all the prepping. All you have to do is assemble your dinner, and you're making it. So if you don't like onions, you can leave onions out. If you love cheese or garlic, you can put extra cheese and garlic in. Then you take them home and put them in your freezer the night, and just pull them out the night that you want to cook them. So we try to make it as easy as possible.
And wow.
They're all very healthy.
Yeah. I mean, I went through you have a really nice little video that you can watch, and I watched the video, and it was just so interesting. So this is your first year with the Living the Dream Ride. What is your future? What do you think? What would you like the Living Dream Ride to look like? You want it to go to other locations or just grow where it is? Or
Absolutely. This is our first year, so we've learned a lot as we've gone along. And it's taking, you know, as you know, I hear you've done years and years of these. It takes a while to get off the ground. But we're trying to build the template so that all of our other Dream Dinner locations can replicate this in their area, and really about the building a community. If we've got stores in Cincinnati, that if they want to put on the bike ride, they can raise money for a local foundation in the Cincinnati area.
Nice.
Yeah, absolutely.
So one more time, it's the Living the Dream Ride. It's next May, 2013, on the day before Mother's Day. It's a Saturday, and there's a rider limit of 500. So if somebody was interested in finding out about it, why don't you give us your website?
You can go to livingthedreamride.org.
Awesome. Well, Tina, this has just been so informative and interesting. And I think from there, if people are interested in your dream dinners, it's kind of interesting. It's a very nice package. And are you willing to let me in on the secret gift or no?
I can tell you that.
But then you'll have to kill me, right?
No. I'll give you a little hint.
Okay.
Everyone that crosses the finish line will receive a luxury Fifth Avenue gift that hangs around your neck.
All righty then. There's the incentive right there.
A little tease.
Well, thanks so much for joining me on the show this evening, and good luck with your event.
Thanks so much.
I'll be looking and seeing how it does.
All right, Diane, thank you.
Have a great evening.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Tina Kuna joined us from Snohomish, Washington.
Yeah, I want her to have a store in Northeast Ohio so that I do not have to make dinner every night. Her dream dinner sounds like such a cool idea. Meanwhile, I also know what the gift is for women, but I'm not saying. My lips are sealed.
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what do you have in the news?
Well, there's quite a bit of news, actually. This was sent to me by one of our listeners. It comes from a website, phys.org, through the Virginia Tech site. It doesn't relate exactly to bicyclists, but it could impact cycling safety. The title of the study is Length of Yellow Caution Traffic Lights Could Prevent Accidents.
Mm-hmm.
Aha, it was posted September 11th of 2012. And it starts out a couple of years ago, Hesham Raka misjudged a yellow traffic light and entered an intersection just as the light turned red. A police officer handed him a ticket. There are circumstances as you approach a yellow light where the decision is easy. If you are close to the intersection, keep going. If you are far away, you stop. If you are almost at the intersection, you have to keep going because if you try to stop, you could cause a rear-end crash with the vehicle behind you and would be in the middle of the intersection anyway, said Raka, who's a professor of civil environmental engineering at Virginia Tech. He's not trying to defend his action. He is the director of the Center for Sustainable Mobility at the Virginia Tech Transportation Institute. He's describing his research. Since 2005, his research group has been studying drivers' behaviors as they approach yellow lights. It's a long article, but it goes on to tell you how long it takes to stop and when to start. And basically, it might impact, based on your speed, how you might judge a car coming through an intersection
mm-hmm.
if you're riding. It's a very interesting article. It goes on and on. The specific findings from the Smart Road study are that 43% of drivers who crossed the stop line during the yellow time were not able to clear the intersection before the light turned red. At 45 miles per hour, it takes 1.5 seconds to clear a 30-meter, 98.4 feet intersection. If the all-red interval is the minimum conventional 1 second, then there is a potential risk that the legal yellow light runners would not be able to completely clear the intersection at the instant the side street traffic gains the right of way. And so it just basically, and it says people over 60 years of age have a longer perception reaction time, so they have to brake harder to stop. And it goes on and on.
Yeah.
He and his team developed a novel procedure to compute the yellow and change interval duration that accounts for the risk of drivers being caught in the dilemma zone. Using this procedure, they have created tables for light vehicles at various speeds for dry roads and wet roads so the traffic planners can set traffic signals that can be adjusted to roadway surface and weather conditions. It's pretty interesting stuff if you're into that, which I am. I like that kind of information.
I've noticed an interesting dynamic coming into intersections where there are cars waiting to make a left turn.
Yeah.
Oncoming traffic.
Okay.
So I'm torn as a cyclist as to whether to go full gas and clear the intersection to, you know, help them make their turn.
Or
to be cautious, worried that they might not be seeing me. And so I want to reduce my speed in case they make a sudden move that's unexpected. I have more time to grab the brakes and try an evasive maneuver. So it's hard to know what to do in some of those situations because you don't want to dawdle through the intersection.
Right.
But you also don't want to put yourself in a bad position either.
It's a very good question. It's more about traffic planning again. And
I started to use my mirror to see, is there a car also approaching the intersection with me? And if I've got a car for cover, then I feel more secure that that car is not going to turn in front of the car.
Just started doing that?
never dawned on me before. If there's no motor vehicle traffic accompanying, then I have to be more cautious because they are less likely to see me by myself than if there's a car a few meters behind me or beside me. So
that's true. We will put a link to the study. It's an interesting study. It's long. If you have an interest in it, it's part of the Science and Technology International Journal of Transportation. I thought it was cool.
Traffic Dynamics geekery.
Geekery.
Two or three people are sitting there nodding their heads, and the rest of them have fallen asleep.
Or they're going. This is their bathroom break. I get it. Okay.
Do you have something a little less dry?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Cycling News reported on September 8th that UCI President Pat McQuaid has raised the possibility of a doping amnesty in order to once and for all deal with a quote unquote tarnished era. The UCI will meet on the 19th and 20th of this month. In an interview with the Associated Press, McQuaid said he will propose the pardon. Quote, I think there's room for it, and I think the UCI could do well to, parenthetically, introduce it, McQuaid said. It's a subject I will bring up myself at the management committee of the UCI, and it's something which we would look into possibly doing. And we all know why they're doing it at this point. We have work in the world, anti-doping rules and sanctions, he concluded. Yada, yada, yada.
Did you hear that there's a mountain bike race that has gone unsanctioned this year so that Lance Armstrong can come back and compete and try and defend his title?
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's the Crested Butte.
Oh, really?
Alpine Odyssey.
Yep.
The race organizer specifically chose to run unsanctioned this year so that Armstrong could compete. It's a 62-mile race, mostly on dirt roads, serves as a qualifier for the Leadville 100.
Which is the killer of all races.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Anyway.
Well, you know what? Stand up and you know, you take your stand. I don't have a problem with that.
Yeah,
it's fine.
He feels it's better for the race to have Lance there.
I'm sure it is, by the way.
Than to be sanctioned. So,
you know, it's very interesting. I think cyclists in general are very forgiving for the most part. They don't like to be lied to. Mm-hmm. Nobody likes to be lied to.
Right.
On the other hand, he was a hero to so many people for so long. You just hate to see him, you know, go up in flames. I don't know. All right.
Move along, Diane.
Lots of chatter about this next item. It was reported on Gizmodo.com. Do you go to Gizmodo?
I sent you this.
Oh, did you?
I think.
No, I saw it on Facebook.
Okay.
All right. A bike this cool can't possibly be made from cardboard or cost $10 to make. By Adrian Covert. The bicycle is one of the most efficient, environmentally friendly modes of transportation, even centuries after its creation. Still, though, there's no lack of innovation happening when it comes to the bike. The latest example is the Alpha. It's a 20-pound bike made primarily of cardboard, which is capable of holding nearly 500 pounds. Oh, and it only costs $10 to make. According to Co-Design, the belt-driven design of the bike makes it a maintenance-free ride, could even be adapted to house an electric motor. In the works for more than 3 years, inventor Izar Gafni is still in the process of raising funds for production, but it's an idea so good it'd be a shame for it not to become reality. It's a really cool-looking bike. It's like all white, mm-hmm, cardboard. I don't know about riding it, though. I just think it's cool-looking. I'd put one up like above my mantle. It's like an art piece. All right.
Wonder how it does in the rain.
It gets wet.
There must be some sort of waterproof.
I would imagine they coat it. You can coat, mm-hmm, that stuff with like a plastic spray, yeah, of some sort.
You can make a boat out of cardboard. You can make a bike out of cardboard.
I would think so. Yeah. Final numbers are in for the National Bike Challenge. 12 million miles.
Whoa.
Yeah. 30,000 participants logged 2 million miles more than the original goal thrown down by Kimberly Clark. It began on May 1st, ended on August 31st. Evidently, the individual with the most miles in those 4 months, 16,000 miles, was a disabled veteran from Topeka, Kansas, by the name of Michael Lemuel. He credits the challenge with increased stamina and self-confidence.
Way to go.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah. All right.
My hometown, by the way.
I know. That's why I decided to do that one. And this is one of the more obnoxious, although tongue-in-cheek, when the source is The Onion. This is the new yellow cheat-to-win bracelet. Come on. According to The Onion store's website, which bills itself as America's finest shopping experience, I'll have you know, you too can have one of these, quote, authentic, official-looking cheat-to-win bracelets sponsored by Balco and worn by great athletes around the world. Cheat-to-win is embossed on the bracelet with HGH, EPO, and testosterone slow-release dispensing bracelet. And it's only $3. Yeah. I had to say that because you have to say what the whole thing is. I don't think it's real. It's the onion.
It's not. It's not real.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
Oh, and speaking of things that weren't real.
Yes.
That letter to the Richmond, Virginia paper about the cracking down on cyclists on the Blue Ridge Parkway.
That was tongue-in-cheek.
I'm sure that was written by a cyclist.
Yes.
That was totally a troll. But yeah. It was well-written.
It was well-written because it had us thinking about it.
Later in the week after I was on a ride actually thinking about that, and I'm like, oh, that was totally, you know, talking
about.
Yeah,
that's what I said. I
the
had
cell phone.
Throwing it out the window.
Yeah, all that stuff.
Yeah, it was baloney.
Yeah.
So remember when we talked with Stephen Ray about the book, Hollywood Rides a Bike?
Yeah.
Yeah, with all the cool people who in Hollywood who had their pictures taken and all that. Well, they reported this week that it's now an app. It's a mega-powered ebook with all the rare and wonderful cycling stars of cinema photos and text from the original Angel City Press publication, scores of new images and more bells and whistles, links and cross-media features that you can possibly imagine. There's a link to get it on iTunes, and then there's a link on ridesabike.tumblr.com, which is Richard's website. I think it's really cool that somebody actually turned that into an app, because I love all those pictures of those Hollywood stars.
Nice.
Which is very good. Last but not least, this is an Interbike notice. This cracks me up. The headline, Interbike organizers are making it harder for consumers to attend the show. This has been the biggest complaint about Interbike. It's that the show is filled with people who are not there to buy. You know, they're not bike shops. They're not vendors. They're just people off the street who want to see the new stuff because there's no consumer day at Interbike, which I think there should be, but that's another story.
But they let non-industry types in?
They don't, quote unquote, let them in. They get in. So they've made the registration much more difficult. We did our registration online, and then they sent us a PIN number by email that you're going to have to show them or download that email and print it out and give them to get your badge. Used to be they mailed your badges. Not anymore. You have to pick them up at the show.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see. And on our way into the studio, Brian said to me that Bicycle Retailer announced that registration by shops is up 20% this year.
Hmm.
We'll see. That's okay. A huge number. So that's all the news I got.
All right, let's take a break.
Okay.
And when we come back, we're going to settle in for a nice long conversation with someone I know is going to be very interesting.
I think so.
All right. So stay tuned right after this on The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
On Saturday, September 29th, you can help rock the block by participating in a 5K run, walk, and roll event designed to raise funds and awareness in the fight against housing discrimination. Presented by the nonprofit Housing Research and Advocacy Center, this family-friendly event takes place at Edgewater State Park on a wheelchair-accessible course. Registration and check-in begin at 8 a.m. All participants will receive T-shirts and refreshments, along with awards to top finishers across several age categories. More information on Rock the Block at thehousingcenter.org.
I'm Greg Pretty.
And I'm Diane Lees.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist, and time to toss it over to a very special guest that we have right here in the studio.
I know. We so rarely get to have this happen. I love it. So Jeff Mapes spent more than 3 years researching and writing Pedaling Revolution, How Cyclists Are Changing American Cities. He lectured at the Cleveland Museum of Natural History last night, and he's in town for the Explorer Series and part of our weekend of Ride for Miles, commemorating the life of biology professor Miles Coburn, who was killed riding his bicycle a few years ago. He's a longtime bike commuter and decided to write his book after watching the growth of a robust urban bike culture in Portland. It is a pleasure to welcome Jeff Mapes to The Outspoken Cyclist. Jeff, thanks for joining me this afternoon.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Yeah, really. And you're really here, like on the campus of John Carroll. Are you enjoying your stay in Cleveland?
Yeah, I mean, I've only been on the ground for about 5 hours now, maybe. But I really enjoyed meeting the several of the students who I talked with at lunch today. And, you know, they were interested in the subject. So that was great.
Well, and the subject's always interesting to me. So that's going to be fun. Are you sticking around for the ride on Sunday, or do you have to
I'll
go back?
Here.
You will.
Yeah.
Oh, good. Well, I'll roll up in my on my little tandem with my partner, Brian. So maybe we'll say hello then. Given your work and the background of what you do as a political columnist and are so involved in cycling, Cleveland is very far behind Portland. And so one of the things I'd like to talk about is how Portland got where it is today and your take on what's going to happen with cycling going forward, transportation-wise, urban-wise, just obesity-wise, all of the things that cycling's so important to me and to our listeners.
Well, I wrote quite a bit about Portland in my book because it really is a fascinating case example of a city that decided to build a pretty complete bike network. You know, it's up to around 300 miles or so, I think, now of combination of bike lanes, low traffic neighborhood greenways, they're called, you know, where they do traffic calming and diverters to mostly make them kind of highways for bikes, bike paths, things like that. And they've really seen a payoff in a really big jump in bike traffic over the last 15, 20 years. You know, if you'd come to Portland in the early 1990s, you would not have said, oh, my gosh, look at all the bikes around town. But now if you were to come here, particularly you, it would be one of the first things you would notice is, especially if you're in kind of the center part of the city on the east side where most people – the inner east side where most people live, you would not be able to go for more than a few blocks without seeing cyclists. They're just part of the landscape.
Well, it's interesting you say that. I was in Portland in the 90s, and I was back for the North American Handmade Show when it was in Portland, and the difference was obvious. There were bicycles and your train system where you can just take a bike and bring it on the train, that little inner city train
right.
system, which is awesome. I would like to see that expanded here in Cleveland. Let's talk a little bit about the idea that Portland went from whatever it was in the 90s to what it is today. What was the impetus with government and with the people involved to give you all those lanes and all these options for cyclists? Who makes those decisions? How did it happen that Portland got to do all these things?
Well, there were a couple of things. I mean, one, Portland is a very environmentally aware city. I mean, there's always been a fair amount of interest in cycling, and there's always been a lot of cycling activists there. I mean, going way back into the 60s and 70s. I mean, they didn't have the kind of power that they did later. There was a very bicycle advocacy group, the Bicycle Transportation Alliance, that started in 1991 and really kind of started almost as an outgrowth of protests over the Iraq War, the initial Persian Gulf War, you know, the whole issue of were we going to war for oil or whatever. And so that was one force that started. The city also had a transportation commissioner at the time, Earl Blumenauer,
oh,
who's
yeah.
now a congressman from the city, head of the Congressional Bike Caucus, who was very interested in increasing bicycling. And the story gets a little complicated, but essentially they hired a pretty determined bicycle coordinator, a woman named Mia Burke, and she really had a lot of political backing from Earl Blumenauer and others on the city council, and she really set out to put together as much of a bike network as possible, did lots and lots of community meetings, develop a bike master plan, and took every opportunity if there was a street that was, you know, was going to be repaved and see if, you know, they could put bike lanes on it. And one thing that they did, and a lot of cities do this, is start with the low-hanging fruit. In essence,
right.
the stuff that's the easiest to do. The road diets where, you know, you say you have a four-lane street, you know, two lanes in each direction. But really there's not necessarily that much traffic on it. Shrink it down to three lanes, one in each direction and a left turn lane in the middle, and then you have room for bike lanes. Or shrink the size of the lanes narrow slightly and get room for bike lanes. And, you know, maybe people didn't notice. One thing that's been – actually had – for the most part, pretty broad support in Portland over the years are these neighborhood greenways. They started out being bike boulevards where because Portland on the east side particularly has a good grid street system.
Right.
You know, they're old streetcar neighborhoods. And so you can find direct routes, you know, near arterials. And so you can build good bikeways along there. And the trick is getting people past difficult intersections, you know, where you where they have to cross a busy street. And Portland's done a lot of interesting things there, too, special signals and things like that.
Yeah, I noticed these sort of boxes at intersections. They're on the ground, but just some interesting things that you have done. In your book, Peddling Revolution, you also talk about Mark Gorton, who I know is a really, really high-profile guy in New York. And it seems like his influence and his money, and money, you know, does talk, actually brought about quite a revolution in New York. So now we've got East Coast, West Coast.
Yeah, and the thing that, you know, one thing that's important about New York for the country is it's such a high-profile city. Things that happen there often get imitated elsewhere, even though New York is such a unique city in
right.
many ways. You know, the density there. One thing that's fascinating to me is, you know, people like Norman Mailer and William F. Buckley, of all people, in the 60s when they ran for mayor, both of them were talking about, you know, everything in Manhattan is so close, we should have more bikeways and use bikes more to get around.
Interesting.
I mean, it goes way back to that even. And they have a transportation commissioner now, Jeanette Sadek Khan, who, you know, has just been a bulldog not only in building a bike infrastructure but in creating public plazas, you know, taking street space away, really – you know, things to encourage active street life and pedestrian use. I mean, she radically changed Times Square,
right.
closed off Broadway through there, and big, big change.
So what do you see as the biggest roadblock to changing the public's perception about cycling? I mean, yesterday you were not here. I don't know if any of our listeners heard this, but we have a guy in town named Mike Trevisano, who is an AM talk radio sports guy, and they went through another Clear Channel bashing of bicyclists. Again, you don't belong on the roads, and you know you're taking your life in your hands. But it got ugly, and it's gotten ugly before. What do you think's going to change people's perception? What's it going to take?
Part of it is time. You know, I'm old enough. I'm in my gosh, do I have to say late 50s?
No, you don't have to say anything.
But, you know, old enough to remember when if you were an adult and you were out cycling to actually get somewhere, you know, just, you know, to get to work or something, people kind of looked at you askance. Were you some sort of loser? Do you even have a right to the road? I mean, it was an unusual thing. And now to younger people, it's much more common. And in some ways, it almost is analogous to the whole gay marriage movement. Look at the polls, how people in their 20s and 30s, they're much more likely to say, well, what's the big deal?
Right.
And that's part of the change. You know, my son is 25 now, rides his bike all over Portland, doesn't own a car. And he's not an activist or he doesn't write about it like his dad does, but he just thinks it's perfectly natural. Why wouldn't I ride places on his bike, and he doesn't think about it. And so part of that is simply cultural change, which, you know, is hard, particularly when you get down to the level of where we live every day. And place we really live every day is right out on the roads.
Right, in our cars,
yeah.
Unfortunately. Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. Would you relate your story about Paul Higgins?
Oh, the guy who did some estimates about boy, this is taking me back. Then he did some estimates about how much you could save if people cycled for an hour every day in terms of
fascinating story, and he came up with some interesting numbers.
Yeah, and I don't remember the exact numbers, but essentially he's a scientist of some kind. You're really catching me unawares.
Okay,
but I mean he essentially said, what if you take if you had people do a half an hour or an hour of their transportation every day by cycling, and substitute and drove those many miles less? So say they were able to ride 12 miles in an hour and drive 12 miles less, and it was amazing the numbers he came up with in terms of how much gas would be saved. I mean, you'd meet the goals that have been set for reducing carbon emissions.
Right.
And now he would be the first to admit you can't just do that, that, you know, a lot of people can't just say, well, I need to go 50 miles today and I'm going to do 12 of them by bicycle, you know, whether through
right.
time or.
Right.
But it gave sort of an – it was one of those things that gave an outer edge of where the possibilities are.
Yeah. I just thought that the story was interesting. And if you want to know the rest of the story, you can read Jeff's book. I want to take a moment to remind our listeners we're speaking with Jeff Mapes. He's here in Ohio from Portland, Oregon, and he's going to be giving a lecture, if you're in town, at the Cleveland Natural History Museum this evening. What's your lecture going to be about?
Well, really the stuff we've been talking about, I really want to just give people a basic sense of how the urban bicycling movement went from something that was the province of – you know, sort of a few activists, really, to something that's a mainstream movement in many cities around the country now.
Well, it's interesting that you say that. On the 13th, there was a women's conference in Long Beach for bringing
right.
more women into cycling. But out of it is going to come a lot of activism. Are you seeing a difference in terms of women and families and children actually riding?
Oh, yeah. Portland, for example, as the number of cyclists has greatly increased, you've been able to the percentage of women has increased. There's still more men out there riding than women. But one thing that's become quite a trend in Portland are the use of cargo bikes, which you hardly ever saw at all. And now they're very common, either the Dutch-style bakfiets with the big box on the front or the extra cycles that have the long tail and are heavy duty. And you'll see it's very common to see moms out there or dads with one or two, or I've even seen three kids on
yeah.
one bike before. But I don't want to overstate it. You know, you won't see as many as you'll see minivans in any half hour span, but it's much more common than it was before. And once again, you know, they're younger families, and you've got to think that as their kids grow up, they're going to have a whole different attitude to this thing. One thing I've been encouraged by is as I go past elementary schools in Portland now, you see a lot more bikes in the bike racks than you did 5 or 10 years ago.
That was going to be my next question. Does Portland have some SRTS, Safe Routes to
yeah,
School programs?
Yeah, they do quite a bit.
Yeah, that's good. That's
yeah,
good.
Yeah. And, you know, that's one thing I think that also deals with some of the issues that motorists raise about cyclists not obeying the laws, running red lights, and things like that. Well, you know, we haven't really offered much in the way of training for people. I mean, basically, cyclists learn from watching others in this country.
That's true. We don't have a real bicycle education program.
Right. And
which
one
would
thing
be a
about
good idea.
Safe routes to school is that at least at an early age, you're offering people some education in how to ride.
Right.
And that is different.
What do you think going forward you're going to see for Portland? Do you see changes there? Because I've had some rumblings that maybe it isn't all so wonderful all the
time. Well, you know, that's a very interesting point. You know, according to the census, we're up at about a 6% mode share for bicycle use now. And that number hasn't you know, it had risen pretty quickly for a while there, and it seemed to somewhat leveled out. You know, part of it may have something to do with the recession that's, you know, fewer people are going to work.
Well, there is that.
Yeah, and so that might have some impact. But also, you know, there is a lot of discussion among the cycling advocates in Portland of, well, if we sort of reached the population we're going to reach with these kind of facilities, and that if you're going to really make another big leap in ridership, that you much more need to emphasize European-style cycle tracks.
Interesting. Interesting. Yes, we had a conversation about cycle tracks with Carrie Caffrey, who teaches Cycling Savvy.
Yeah, you might want to explain what the – you know, those are basically protected
pathways
from traffic. Like you'll have parked cars between the motorized traffic and the bicycles or some sort of barrier.
Right. Right.
Something like that. And we've started putting some in Portland, but still it's a very small part of the network.
Well, it was just an interesting point that I was trying to think. Cleveland is sort of, you know, we're always 10 years behind California. So I imagine we're 10 years behind Oregon, too, when it comes to cycling. And we're starting to see some changes here where they're going to put a dedicated bike lane on a bridge, for example, that goes from east to west. I don't know if you've discovered that we have an east and west in Cleveland yet because of the Cuyahoga River and the way the city was built. But people who need to get across that bridge or those bridges, a lot of them want to ride because we have this little area called Ohio City and Tremont, which is this tiny little, you know, we're refurbishing it. A lot of young people are living there but need to work on the other side in downtown. So we're seeing some things now that probably Portland saw 10 years ago. And so I'm kind of looking backwards at Portland to see what might be happening here.
You know, making the bridges more bicycle friendly was huge. The most popular bike bridge in Portland, the Hawthorne Bridge, once had very, very narrow sidewalks. And they expanded out as much as they could on that bridge. It's an old bridge, you know, without literally unbalancing it. It's
right.
A drawbridge. And I think it's about 10 feet, the sidewalks are 10 feet wide now. And frankly, it's not enough because the bikes are really jammed on it. They're now 20% of the traffic on that bridge. I have a slide I'll show tonight, in fact, where it shows people lined up to get onto the bridge. And there's times riders will complain of having to sit through two cycles of the light before they get on the bridge. I've never actually seen that myself. But when the green light comes and people – you know, head up onto the bridge. It's like the, you know, the Peloton at Tour de France or something.
It never occurred to me that there could be bicycle rush hour.
Oh, absolutely,
but,
yeah.
Yeah, you
if
know.
I ride at different times. Sometimes I work at home first in the morning. But if I'm riding to work between 8 and 9, I'll see many, many more riders
sure.
than between 9 and 11.
What kind of bike do you ride?
Oh, I have a garage full of bikes.
Of course you do.
People tease me about that. I've done different things through the years. Right now, for the last 5 or 6 years, my favorite commuting bike has been a Specialized Cirrus, actually. It's kind of halfway between a hybrid and a road bike.
Yeah, that's a nice bike. It's Specialized, that Cirrus bike. Yeah, I
see a lot of those in Portland.
Yeah,
I'll
bet.
And, you know, they kind of give me the speed. If I'm riding with friends who are on road bikes, I can kind of sort of keep up. Yeah.
Do you do any long distance riding?
Yeah, I have a road bike too, and I'll go out on the weekend and do that. I got to tell you though, there's nothing I love more than just riding around the city. You know, particularly with friends, we'll, you know, maybe go somewhere to go to lunch or, you know.
Do you shop?
Basically, my attitude is I have a 4 or 5 mile bike shed, I kind of call it.
Okay.
And anything within that, there's got to be a good reason for me not to bike. And, I mean, I have a cargo bike, so I do you know, most of our grocery shopping with that. And, you know, so that's most of the travel I do within that area. And, you know, and then if it gets longer than that, I'll think, well, you know, do we want to do this or what? I see bicycling – I'm not a fanatic in the sense of everything's got to be by bike. I'm anti-car. I own a car. But, you know, we've gone from 2 cars to 1 car.
Oh, cool. That's cool. I want to do that.
And we have it's this fun new car share system that's come into Portland. It's called Car2Go, where they rent cars by the minute. And you can – they're little smart cars and you can – you know, you just look on your app on your iPhone and it'll tell you where the closest one is. You go to it, you know, and open it up. There's a way to do that with this key card I have. And then you charge something like 35 cents a minute and you can drop it anywhere.
It's like bike share, only it's car share. Do you have a bike share in Portland?
They have bids out there.
Do they?
In the process,
yeah.
But it's been kind of slow. It's been delayed, so we'll see. I think at some point it's going to come.
Well, this has been way fun. Boy, that time went fast,
just
really
like that.
Fast, just like that zip. So you're going to enjoy a dinner this evening? Do you know what's going on for dinner? Are they taking you someplace cool?
I haven't heard yet.
I did hear that maybe you're going to be down at the House of Blues tonight.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see. I flew in on the red eye, so we'll see how long I last.
I got it. Okay, maybe it's just the house of sleep tonight. All right, well, thank you so much for joining me on the show this afternoon. I hope you enjoy your stay here in Cleveland. I'm sorry you brought in a little rain from Portland, it seems.
It's not unheard of in Portland.
Yeah, no, so I hear. I hope you have a great trip back home, and don't forget, Peddling Revolution by Jeff Mapes. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Well, our thanks to Jeff Mapes for stopping in the studio.
Yes, indeed.
To talk with us about all things Portland, all things commuting.
And it turns out he is not just about bicycling and commuting. Actually, he's the author of a political blog, Mapes on Politics, and is a regular contributor to the Oregon Public Broadcasting.
Nice.
He is the political reporter for the Oregonian.
I really have to see Portland firsthand. I'm becoming more and more convinced of it every day.
Really?
Yeah.
I've been there several times. I love it. It's a beautiful city. It's a fun city.
And, you know, we've talked about this. I forget which guest it was because we've had a lot of guests on from Portland.
You think?
But, you know, how they didn't buy into the whole let's cut through the heart of the city with an interstate thing back in the, you know,
no,
60s, 70s.
Right.
And so that has really shaped what the possibilities are.
I think it
Portland.
Was Ellie Blue who talked to us about that.
Yeah. And, you know, we really suffer from that in Cleveland. Our interstates are wonderful things, but they really divide us in a way that we don't often fully understand, I think.
I agree with you.
I certainly wasn't around when, you know, to see it before and after, but I think it's a big change that we don't fully appreciate.
They were building 71 up from the Cincinnati through Columbus area when I moved here.
Mm-hmm.
But it was not done when I first got here because you still had to go through the city to get to the airport.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoyed that ride.
Yeah.
It wasn't long. But, you know, I agree. I think that running the interstates through the city has not done Cleveland any good for the citizens of the area, the inhabitants. You know, we have this divisive kind of east-west argument all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we all know the east side's better. I just had to say that.
Because that's where we are.
Exactly. That's where John Carroll is.
All right. Well, settle down, you west siders. We love you, too.
We were just pulling your chains.
Thanks for listening from wherever you might be, Cleveland, west, east, or somewhere else, even outside of the U.S. And I'll be back here. Diane will be in Las Vegas next week, but she'll be calling in to tell us who she's corralled into an interview.
Oh, a bunch of people.
Yep.
All right.
So, ride safely, and we'll see you then.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at wjcu.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at wjcu.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.